You're listening to Extra Time, driven by Continental.
TMZ, oh my goodness.
I'll let Bobby Warsaw tell me how I did it.
I think he's the philosopher of football.
I'd like to have some more derbies.
Absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, I like it. I liked it a lot.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here!
From New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time, driven by Continental from the AT&T MLS Studios in Midtown Manhattan. 2020 is here. I'm Andrew Wiebe, David Goss, Matt Doyle are here. My partners in soccer, we're in a weird limbo, because it's actually 2019.
You know what would have been funny? If you brought that show in as, instead of New York, New York, New Year, New Year.
Oh, I don't.
Wordplay.
I'm not a fan of that.
How are we in 2019? Is this a time travel episode?
It's a little bit like
It's sort of like Lucas Cavallini, like he's 26,
right?
But he's really 27. It's 2020.
26 as we're recording this, 27 as
correct.
Being listened
to. Exactly, exactly. Now, we are not in studio, as you can tell here. Dax McCarty is coming up. We have about an hour interview with him talking about his career. About
everything's a paradox.
It was actually done before Nashville made that trade. So he might be talking about his future in uncertain terms, but now you know what his future is and can extrapolate a little
bit. Also, at the time, I think he knew what his future was.
That was probably true. Probably true. He told me he didn't, but he probably did. Before we get into it, I have a quick trivia question for you, and it's very important because our Swedish producer Anders has been asking about this for months at this point. Which Scandinavian / Nordic country are we most popular in? The most downloads of Extra Time comes from which country?
Well,
what
there's a difference between Scandinavian countries and Nordic countries.
I would ask you to educate us, but we've all done the research. Clearly, if you listen to the show, you're very familiar.
I would say we're obviously the most popular in Sweden because of Zlatan.
Exactly. Sweden is number one. Congratulations, Anders. You've been waiting for that.
Trivia if you don't get it all, get a chance to answer.
Oh, well, who do you think is second?
I'm going to guess Sweden's number one.
Yes, exactly. Great job. Great job, Dave.
Norway is second because of Ole Kamara.
Yeah, Norway, that'll crush Anders' spirits. And then, between Norway,
do we have
Sweden,
any Faroese players?
We don't have any Danish players. We don't,
either,
but we do have a number of Danish listeners.
Yeah, we get a bunch of emails from Copenhagen.
Correct. We get,
Copenhagen's supposed to be beautiful.
Yeah, it is. From people who work in clubs in Copenhagen, actually. Yeah. And then, actually, Finland is last, and they're just Nordic. They're not even Scandinavian.
There you go. So Weeby's on my side. Boom.
They're also the smallest population, so while they lack in numbers, they make for up in might.
Perfect. You going to tell some lies about saunas now?
No, I love Finland.
Saunas? How are they
saying?
Saunas? Sauna.
All right, that's enough of us. Dax McCarty right here. We'll see you in a couple days, everybody. Welcome back into the AT&T MLS studios. Another fireside chat, if we were to have a fire and blankets and hot cocoa. Dax McCarty's here. What's up, Dax?
How you guys doing, man?
That's just me. There's no guys here.
Enjoying the city, man. Yeah. That's all I'm doing.
Good. Who'd you go to lunch with today?
Oh, man, what a motley crew of former and current legends. A couple Red Bull guys, couple enemies, NYCFC guys. Let's see who was in there. Chris Wingert, staple in the New York City soccer scene. Some of my Red Bull boys, Ryan Mira, Sean Davis, and then only the most diehard Red Bull fans would remember my boy Johnny Barajo.
Oh, how could you forget?
Yeah, he's a Jersey boy, born and raised. It was a great crew. Had a good time. Caught up.
So we're going to talk about just about everything from your career. If we have time to do it, we'll try to get through it. But I want to start and sort of warm you up with your time in New York City, because you were one of the few guys that avoided the suburban New Jersey, close to the training center lifestyle. You said, nah, I'm going to plant my roots right here. I believe it was in the West Village, Christopher Street.
No? Correct.
Why did you make that decision? What was the best thing about that decision, and what are the things that you remember? Do you miss it all? You're in you're in Hyde Park now, or somewhere hip in Chicago?
Logan Square.
Yeah, somewhere hip.
Brooklyn of Chicago is what I hear.
I'll be the judge of that.
You know what? It was funny, because when I got traded, I milked my time. They put us up at the W at that time, so I think I was at the W for like 4 or 5 months, actually.
So people that don't know, that is like waterfront
in Hoboken,
overlooking. That's where all the visiting teams to the Red Bulls stay.
And it's the W.
Yeah, it's,
what's not
it's
to
beautiful.
Love? Yeah. I milked that for all it was worth. Finally found a place. I was by myself, so I decided to stay in Hoboken. That was kind of the easy training wheels way to introduce myself.
It was I'm a young man. I still want to go out,
sure.
But I'm not in the city. I have to go to training. It was the middle ground.
Right. It was the middle ground of where I could live and still be consider myself a respectable soccer player at that point, because I wanted to be like, all right, I don't live in the city. I live in Jersey, but I'm close to the city, so I can still go and enjoy it. But after a year, I was living there, and I would always tell one of my buddies who I went to college with, I would always be like, oh man, you got to come to see my place. Like, look at this view of the city. And he would always come back with the same bit. He'd be like, oh, that's great. You get a nice view of the city. Why don't you actually come live in the city? That's a little bit different. And I was like, it never really affected me until he kept doing it over and over and over again. And so finally, when my lease was up in Hoboken, as fate would have it, his lease was coming up in the city, and we decided to try to look for a place together. And so looked for a place together, probably looked at about 5 or 6 places. It was a process of elimination. We had one with like a 6-story walk-up, no elevator. One of them had no washer dryer, no, you know, all these different things. And it's just eye-opening. I'm like, wait, these places don't have washer dryers? These places don't have microwaves?
Central air.
These places don't have central air. I was like, what's going on here?
Closets.
They're like, no, yeah, you got one window that you can crack open and you could throw an AC unit in there. And I'm just like, okay, well, what about storage? They're like, storage? What's that? Literally, you're going to live, like, put all your stuff under your bed, and that's how you're going to live.
This ain't Dallas.
No. But you know what's funny? Funny enough, I was about ready to give up, and I was about ready to re-sign my lease in Hoboken. The last place that our realtor showed us was an amazing place right near the water, Christopher and Washington Street in West Village. It worked out for both of us. It was at a relatively cheap price, and I say relatively because you know what I'm talking about. The prices here are asinine. But we found a place. It had a washer dryer. It had a dishwasher, which was like heaven. Decided to take it. Made the jump. Lived in the city for about 5 years.
Shangri-La, man. You're describing Shangri-La. That's like you get everything you want, and it's in the West Village. That doesn't happen. Before we get to your career here, were you like, you have a bodega?
I did.
Regular spots? The bar you go to for a pint? What was your lifestyle like in the city?
Had the bodega.
Who were you in the neighborhood?
Yeah, I was the guy. I wasn't into coffee. I just started getting into coffee more recently. I was the young guy. I didn't really have a coffee shop I frequented. If I went to a coffee shop, it was mainly just to get hot chocolate. Like, I was that guy. You know, I'd be like, oh, I'll just have a hot chocolate, please. And it was kind of like just to get out of the apartment. But I did have a bodega. It's called Gourmet 157, right there off of Washington Street. What's up, boys, at Gourmet 157? Yeah. We had, they had a bodega cat there that was just like...
You a turkey sandwich guy, a bagel guy?
On my mood.
Bacon, egg, and cheese?
Depended on my mood. Classic. It was hit or miss. I'm like, I'm a turkey sandwich guy, but I also enjoyed egg salad. But egg salad at the bodega, it could be really hit or miss. Some days I thought it was gourmet and like Gourmet 157. Other days I was like, I don't know, guys. I don't know what's going on here with your... So it would just be however I was feeling. I switched it up a lot.
So this is a different time of your life than the time when you went to Bradenton as a teenager. I can't imagine that you were thinking while you were there, oh man, New York City lifestyle is coming my way in a couple of years. I'm going to play for the Red Bulls in a beautiful soccer-specific stadium. Walk me through you, the fill-in-the-blank, your old teenager who's faced with a big decision, who's thinking, hey, I'm pretty good at soccer.
Yeah.
Who were you? What were you thinking?
I was the scared, ambitious, slightly arrogant teenager that basically got sat down by his parents when he was 15 years old. And they said, look, we don't want this to happen selfishly, but we're going to tell you that you got called up to the under-17 national team in Bradenton, Florida. They want you to go live over there. They want you to move out of the house. They want you to do this, that. And I said, when can I leave? It was literally like, when can I leave? And I was a little bit nervous. I was a little bit scared. But I had been a part of the youth national teams growing up. And I always told myself, you know, the key to continuing to progress and get better and better is to play with the best players in the country. And at that time, and I think for the most part, people would agree that the residency program, that's where the best players in the country went. Now, obviously, we can open up a whole other can of worms and talk about scouting, and we probably don't get to near as many kids as we need to. But at the time, that's where the best players in the country that were identified would go. And so you lived and breathed soccer. I mean, when I was growing up, I trained twice a week on a football field with kids that were in college as my coaches. They were playing college soccer at a local college in Orlando, Florida called Rollins College. It's actually where my wife went. It's where we met. But it was kids from England who were 18 years old. They were coaching us on the side to make a buck. And I thought to myself, I'm just not getting better. You know, they were great guys and they were amazing people, but I wanted to push myself and I wanted to keep pushing the envelope. And so going to residency made sense. Went to residency, made a lot of lifelong lasting relationships that I'll always cherish, but I think it made me better. And I think that springboarded me to to tell myself in residency was when I told myself, you're going to be a professional soccer player. Like, that's your dream. You're going to go for it. You're in residency. Take the next step.
Who were your roommates or roommate? Who were the guys you connected with? What was that class?
That class was the 1987 class. So a lot of...
I've learned very quickly that soccer players speak in...
When you were
birth
born.
Birth years. Yep. It's all about birth years. Oh, yeah. The 87s. Oh, no, yeah, but the 91s.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, you're fluent in that lingo now.
Yeah, I'm an 86.
That's what you have to do. There you go. Yeah. See? Old man you are. Anyways, so we had a good group, right? That was the group. I mean, Freddie Adu, I think, was in like 6 residency classes. So I'm not going to claim Freddie for just ours. But it was his last one, was with us. Michael Bradley, Danny Zatella, Julian Valentin. Still keep in touch with Julian Valentin. Just a bunch of random names from the past. And my roommates were guys that actually ended up playing in college, but they didn't do too much professionally. A guy named Adam Sloster, outside back. I'm still really close with him. Greg Folk. Nathan Sturgis.
Oh, yeah.
Great friend of mine who obviously kept in touch with. Florida boy. So we were both the Florida boys down in residency. And Nate was a good friend of mine. Played in a bunch of different... He played on so many different teams in his career, and it was... a disappointment that we never crossed paths in the MLS.
Yeah, he's like a trivia answer.
He should be. Him and like maybe Kai and Dominic Oduro, you know.
Guys,
but I think
you're like 7-8 stops, I think been Nate, everywhere. You're like, he played for Chivas? What?
I think Nathan Sturgis played in MLS for like 9 years, 8 or 9 different teams. So I still think he probably takes the cake.
So tell me about the environment. You described those guys, and this is a lot of the team that eventually would go to Canada with the U-20s and be so good as well. What was Michael Bradley like when you guys were 15? What is Freddie Adu like in that scenario where he's been there for so long and everybody's like, that's Freddie Adu. Like that, he's a star even then.
I've got to admit, I mean, still to this day, he was at the time, and even looking back on it now, the most talented player I'd ever seen. I mean, we were 15, 16-year-old kids, and he was supposedly 12 or 13 at the time. I believe you, Freddie. Don't worry. And he was making full internationals, full MLS players look foolish. Easily the best player on the field. Whenever we would scrimmage them, we'd play. They would be in preseason. They'd come down there. They'd play us. Freddie was easily the best player on the field. And it was actually mind-blowing to me that he was as good as he was. I was like, I could not wrap my head around how dominant this guy was. So he was truly a rock star in every sense of the word. And I think Freddie has admitted this, actually, in numerous interviews since, but it all got to his head. And you could see that, you know, you could see he was arrogant. He walked around with like a brash, almost cockiness, because he was that good. But I think once he turned pro, once he went to MLS, he signs a $1 million deal with Nike. These are all things that are tough to deal with. I mean, I can't imagine dealing with that as an 18 or 19 year old. Imagine dealing with that as a 14 year old, right? And so these are all things that I think are really tough to deal with, and you see that, you know, it's been humbling for him, I think, going to and bouncing around to different clubs. But back then, wow, I mean, different level. Michael is the exact same as he always was. I mean, just the guy lives, eats, breathes soccer, and that's how he was. And when we were all talking about what colleges we wanted to go to, everyone knew that maybe like Danny Zatella, Freddie, they were the big guys and they were going to turn pro, but everyone else was going to go to college. And we were asking Michael, well, what college are you going to go to? And Michael was like, I don't think I'm going to go to school. I think I'm going to turn pro. And back then, you know, Michael wasn't the cream of the crop back then. He wasn't considered a highly touted prospect. Everyone knew about Bob and his dad. But, I mean, to see the progression from when Michael was a 16-year-old to turning pro, getting drafted by the Metro Stars, not playing, playing 1 year in MLS, going to Europe, and just consistently proving himself and getting better and moving along the way to these different bigger clubs. I mean, it was unbelievable. The way that Michael took himself from what you would call, I guess, an average prospect at the time and made himself one of the best players to ever wear the U.S. men's national team jersey. To see that progression has been really, really incredible.
What were the signs that you saw at that time that it was possible, even if his reputation as a teenager wasn't up here? What was he doing? What were you seeing day to day? How did that sort of manifest itself, this obsession with the game?
You could see the reason he was why he was, and it was because of Bob. I mean, this guy was obsessed with the game, and he had the building blocks that you need to be a great player, right? I mean, he was extremely dedicated. He was extremely focused. He was extremely fit. I mean, back then when we were
Is this like you wake up, you guys are still sleeping, and he's like coming in from a jog sort of dedication?
No, this is more just like anytime there's a game on, like, I'm going to watch a game. Oh, you guys want to go see a movie? Hey, Michael, we're going to go see a movie. We're going to hop on the school bus with all these other kids, and we're going to go to a movie, and then we're going to come back. We'll talk to some girls. You know, we'll try to send some AIM messages.
For sure. Yeah.
I think it was AIM, AOL Instant Messenger back then.
And, yeah, yeah.
And
what was your login name?
My screen name was Soccer11MMS. It was soccer, but it was spelled with two K's.
Of course.
Because that was cool. You didn't want to spell it like normal soccer. And my number growing up was 11.
Gotcha.
So it had to be 11. And then
you needed your font to be reflective of your personality as well.
Any guesses what MMS stood for?
MMS. Something with, I don't know.
Maitland Middle School. Because that's when I created the screen name.
I was thinking Mutant Gene, but I couldn't fit that one in very well. Yeah.
Yeah, I do accept that. But Maitland Middle School, because that's when I created the account. And then I was using it in high school, and I was like, wait, MMS.
But at that point, you're established.
There you go.
So Michael's quote unquote average on the field. I remember at Heerenveen and just being like, oh my God, this is.
He wasn't. I mean, look, we're talking about guys that are on the under 17 national.
They're all really good.
He wasn't average, but he was, you could just tell, like, Freddie Adu, Danny Zatella, studs. Like, in our class, those were the guys. I mean, at the time, Danny had Everton sniffing around him and was saying, like, Danny's going to sign this contract at 17 with Everton, and they're going to pay him $1 million a year. Freddie's going to be the number one overall draft pick. He's already got this $1 million deal from Nike. I mean, we're talking about, like, back then, I mean, that's like, oh, 405. Yeah. I mean, that's we're talking big time. This is before MLS was even half of what it is today, right? So you're
eyes
talking
wide,
about,
no matter who you are,
exactly.
Veteran, so in the league, whatever.
Exactly.
It was.
I mean, you're talking big money. I think Freddie was the highest paid guy, was making the most money in MLS, and he was 14. So and Danny was just as big time. Michael wasn't on that level. He just wasn't. And everyone knew his dad was Bob, and everyone knew that Michael was a good player, but it's just the way that he carried himself. And Michael still, to this day, carries himself the same way he did back then. And that's just because, you know, I think he's a Bob disciple. I think they both live and breathe the game. Bob was a guy that Michael grew up in Bob's locker rooms. And so you could tell from the earliest time I met Michael that he knew exactly who he was. He knew exactly who he wanted to be. And then the progression was great, right? Like, he always was super fit, and he was always a pretty good passer. But I think the things that Michael added later, you know, those are things that everyone can, the mentality was always great, but it's the technique. It's the touches in the middle of the field. It's the being aware of your surroundings. It's the soccer IQ. And he had all those building blocks, but at Heerenveen, he improved those, right? The goal scoring ability, his late runs into the box. And that's the other thing about Michael, is that he's evolved a lot as a player, right? He was a number 8. And then he was kind of like a hybrid number 10, box-to-box midfielder, and now he's kind of established himself as a number 6, right? So he could play all those roles, and I think as a player, you just see the progression that he's had, and it's really impressive. And I was, you know, I'm happy to have been there along for the ride.
You have a great career yourself. Let's talk about you for a little bit. Let's go to FC Dallas. You get drafted out of UNC. What's the locker room like that you walk into? What's the personality collection?
Intimidating. Very intimidating. A lot of older, more established veteran guys. I didn't know what I was getting into, to be honest. I was this like brash, arrogant kid. I was Generation Adidas. I was the number 6 overall pick.
Oh, those are the worst.
Yeah, we really are. And we're a terrible bunch.
Guaranteed money.
Sasha was the number 5 overall pick. He went right before me. I went in there and my expectations were that I was going to play right away and that I was going to be on the field, and it didn't matter who my competition was. And I went into that locker room, and we had a lot of older, experienced veteran guys. Our head coach was Colin Clark. He was a guy that was a little intimidating himself, but I mean, I went in there and I immediately gravitated towards Bobby Ryan, who was a guy, if people listening, if they don't know who he is, search him, search some videos of him. He's one of my mentors and one of my closest friends in the league. Passed away, heart condition. But he was a guy who just took me under his wing. He was so just easygoing, and he made you feel comfortable right away. And I was 18 years old at the time, and I didn't really know what I was getting myself into. He had this ease about him that just made you feel so comfortable. And turned out I didn't play at all my first year. I played 2 games for a total combined of like maybe 12 minutes, and it was a really big eye opener. And that at that point, I thought I made a mistake. I thought to myself, I don't know why I left college to come turn pro and play 10 minutes.
So how did that change? How does that change?
It changes when you know, you have faith in yourself, you have faith in your convictions, you do things for the right reasons, you have this constant hunger to prove yourself and this constant desire to prove yourself. In preseason, that year 2006 that I got drafted, I was playing with the starting 11 basically all throughout preseason. We had a couple older guys that were injured and they weren't playing as much. My only question mark going into the season was, am I going to start the first game of the year or am I going to be on the bench? I wasn't even in the 18. And it was just, it kind of hits you right in the face. I'll tell you a quick story about Oscar Pareja. I didn't make the 18 in the first game of the season. And I was so petty and I was so angry and I was such a little baby about it that we had a reserve game the next day.
And Oscar is the reserve coach for those that don't know at this time.
Oscar was just getting into coaching at the time. He was the reserve coach. And we played the Dallas Texans. And it was a big club in Dallas, big club in the nation before academies. I mean, they produced Lee Wynn, yeah, Johnny Villanueva, just some names from the past. But they produced some big time players and they had a good team. And I think Andre Akpan, our old boy Andre Akpan, I believe Andre was a Texan. I'm not sure about that, but sorry, Andre, if you weren't. But anyways, we played them in a reserve game. They smashed us 3-0. Club team playing a professional reserve team. They smashed us 3-0. I had a terrible game. I had a terrible attitude. And Oscar, he took us to the side. we all sat us down in a circle. And he just lit me up in front of everyone, harder than I've ever been lit up in my whole career. He destroyed me. He said, I don't know who you think you are. You haven't proven anything to anyone yet. You come on the field and you act like you're owed something and you're not owed anything. Nobody on this team, nobody at this club owes you a thing. You haven't proven anything yet. And you think you should be playing over there? Well, then you have to come on the field and you have to prove it over here first. And that really resonated with me. And it was kind of the kick in the ass, if you will, that I needed. Sorry about that. But it was kind of just like saying, okay, you're coming from the under 17 national team. You're coming from college. Now you're in a pro. You're in a professional environment. And things are a little bit different here. You're going to have to prove yourself. Talent doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be on the field. So that whole first year, I kept my head down. I worked hard. One of the reasons I wanted to turn pro was to give myself a better chance to make the under 20 national team to go to the World Cup in Canada, which it did. That's something Thomas Rongen told me. He's like, look, I would like to have as many pros as I can. That was a factor in my decision. So it turned out that offseason, you know, I worked hard, worked my way into the lineup. I played a lot more in 2007. I made the U-20 World Cup team 2007, went to Canada. So all those things, it added up to it being the right decision. But that 2006 year was really difficult.
What legends were in that locker room? I think about FC Dallas at that time, and you got Kenny Cooper, and you've got David Ferreira, who's coming in there. I mean, Heath Pierce is around. Brooke Shea is in there. It's a young team. It's a veteran team. It's a South American team. You have Shelce Hinman, who we all know is taking blows to the nether regions with nary a blink. I mean, he's sort of an interesting character, let's just say that.
A lot of cult heroes in those groups. Yeah. We can go back even further to like my rookie year. We had guys like Pescadito Ruiz.
Oh God, give me the best Pescadito Ruiz story that you've got. Were you there for the Rico Clark kick? Or
I was on the field, and I was like, "Am I in a movie right now?" Like I thought Ashton Kutcher was about to jump out and like be like, "All right, whole, you guys got
that was,
punked."
Yeah, that was definitely the punked era.
I was like, "Oh my God, like what are you doing?" And so Carlos, I mean, he was such a great guy, and I had never played against him at this point, so he was only my teammate, so I knew his reputation, the fish, but I had never seen someone so angry. I mean, Rico always played hard, right?
But mild-mannered, generally.
Mild-mannered guy, like really tough guy to get under his skin. And it was just like, all right, it's Carlos. Yeah, it makes sense. So he just wound up, and it was like they were smashing us. I think Houston was beating us like 2-3-0 on our own field. And Carlos was just like, it was his antics trying to get under the skin. And I saw him kick him, and Carlos grabbed his face, so I wasn't sure. I was like, oh, my God, he just kicked him right in the face. And then everyone was freaking out, going crazy. The Houston guys were like, he didn't kick him in the face. He didn't kick him in the face. I'm like, what are you guys talking about? He just kicked him in the face. The guy's grabbing his face. And it was like, oh, it's Carlos. And right. I think Carlos was giving it one of these, like one of those.
Yeah,
like,
maybe looking through. But it was
he connected.
Yes.
He connected with the shoulder pretty well. And I don't know if Carlos can file workers' comp for that or not. But that was amazing. I mean, we had Carlos Ruiz, Dario Sala. Our goalkeepers at the time, Dario Sala, Shaka Hislop, Jeff Kassar. I mean, unbelievable band of goalkeepers. Just such an eclectic group of guys, right? And then you get into Breck. You get into my boy Eric Avila. Eric Alexander came in there. Zach Lloyd. I mean, George John. Ugo Ehemelu. I mean, all these guys that were such good, like, just good locker room guys, great soccer players. You added David Ferreira, who ended up being one of our best signings that I think FC Dallas ever made. Won the MVP that year in 2010. that 2010 year was still a magical year. One of the best years, one of the most enjoyable years of my career.
Have I heard correctly that you owned a house in Dallas? That you
I did.
Both. It was like the it was like the bro house, and then when you left, you rented it out to a succession of FC Dallas players.
So that's partly accurate, partly inaccurate. After I left, I didn't rent it out to a couple players. I had a buddy from college who was actually living there at the time. And
better move.
Yeah, I think I'd spoken to the club about it. I'd spoken to the club about maybe saying, look, put all the rookies up in this house. Didn't really know what I was doing at the time. I think I was like 20, 22, 23 years old, and I honestly had no clue what it meant to be a landlord. And so I thought, oh, if I could get some players in here. But my college buddy, he had some people to live there, and my college buddy was an old soul, so he took care of it, and I think that was the better option. But yeah, it was the bro house. We had at my first year in MLS, in that house was living me. I had my own room. Blake Wagner, Michael Delarusso, assistant coach at Houston right now, and a guy named Justin Moore went to Clemson. His brother actually played in MLS. Jason Moore, I think he was. I think it was a first overall draft pick back in the 90s. Could be wrong. Trivia. It's trivia for some people, but it was just such a fun, interesting experience. And looking back on those days, there are so many, seeing my life back then to where it is now. I actually sold my house in Dallas recently. So it was in Frisco, and Frisco's blown up. For those that don't know, Frisco back in 2005.
What an investment for the McCarty family.
Great investment. But now, like, the Dallas Cowboys have their training facility out there. There's like actual Whole Foods and malls. Mm-hmm. And back then it was like you have like a Whataburger, maybe a grocery store. And then you have, like, it was called Pizza Hut Park back then. And you had FC Dallas Stadium. Now it's got all the Hall of Fame, and they've done all this construction. But, yeah, looking back on those days, I mean, those days, I thought I would be at FC Dallas forever, to be honest. I mean, then Shellis came in. Him and I didn't see eye to eye on a lot of things. But even after we made that run in 2010 to MLS Cup, I thought I would still be there, to be honest.
You weren't. It got a little weird for you, personally. Expansion draft. That's Portland Timbers, right? And then
right.
Traded to DC, yep. And you were the captain, but not for long. And then the Red Bulls.
That was a whirlwind of a time for me.
Take me through that part of your life. Did you expect to go in the expansion draft? Were they like, hey, you're not protected? They're probably going to take you.
I'll take you inside what being in an MLS locker room was back in 2010. We had just played MLS Cup. We lost in Toronto. It was absolutely dreadful.
Matt Kanji game.
Dreadful game, dreadful conditions. It was freezing cold, rain, like sideways rain. I can't imagine being a fan going to those
games.
That's
the game that killed the neutral field.
That's what I thought. I was going to say, I think that's the last game that was ever played on the neutral
I don't think
field.
This is what we want to do.
And so we had just finished a great season. We had beaten Real Salt Lake, who was a perennial contender at that point. We had beaten LA Galaxy in a one-off game at LA 3-0 to make it to MLS Cup. I mean, it was just like a magical season. I think we had a 19-game unbeaten streak, which at the time, it may still be tied for an MLS record for one of the longest unbeaten streaks in league history. We just had a really good way about us. We had a great team, amazing locker room. After we lose the MLS Cup final, really sad, we spend the night, we fly home on a charter, and we're all partying in the back of the plane. We're celebrating a good season. Guys get back, we hop on the bus. Everyone's had a good time, and we're going back, and at this point, I mean, you literally had to have your expansion draft list in the next day after MLS Cup, or maybe 2 days after MLS Cup. So we get back to the locker room. Guys are all calling cabs to go home, and they bring us together in the locker room, and legitimately right then and there, they read a list of players that are protected and not protected. They just read it out. They say, they give you no prior warning, nothing. It's just like, all right, everyone's in the locker room. This is who's protected. Everyone else, if your name wasn't called, you're unprotected. And so obviously my name wasn't called. And, you know, I felt like I had a good year. I was starting. I had a good MLS Cup. And I was just like, I was kind of seeing stars for a little bit. And I was like, okay, that's interesting. I wonder what's going to happen now. So I spoke with my agent, and he said, look, you're probably going to get taken the expansion draft. A few days before that, I get a phone call from Ben Olsen, and Ben's like, listen, I want you in D.C. And if you want to be in D.C., like, we're pulling trigger. We want to trade for you. I was like, absolutely. D.C. United, history, back on the East Coast. Ben was a legendary midfielder in and of itself, a guy I have a ton of respect for, a guy I really felt like would be amazing to play for. Even though he was a young coach, mm-hmm. he was just starting out. That was his first full season going to be in charge. So the expansion draft thing happens. I already knew I was going to D.C., so I guess it's always fun for people to say, oh, you know, Dax McCarty played for Portland for an hour.
But you knew that was temporary.
I knew it was temporary. And so I always just wondered, and that, because it was actually a big trade. You know, Rodney Wallace went from D.C. over to Portland. But yeah, I knew I was never going to be a Timber, which looking back on it, it obviously, I think the things that that Portland has done, I think it would have been really nice to play for that club. But went to D.C. Ben Olsen made me captain. I think I was 23 years old. And, you know, Ben was like, look, we have a new team. We have a lot of veteran guys, but honestly, I don't know who's going to be on the field a lot. I think you're a guy who's going to be on the field all the time for me, and I like what you bring to the table, so I want to make you captain. And I'm young. I'm like 23. I'm looking at like Josh Wolf, Santino Quaranta, Clyde Sims, like all these guys that have been in the locker room, been veteran guys, national team guys. And I'm sitting there coming in as this 23-year-old who just didn't really know what he was doing. And he made me captain. And I think I've always said this. My biggest regret about my time in D.C. was that I focused on that armband a little bit too much, because I focused on trying to be a good captain and hold other people accountable and not hold myself accountable to be better. And you could argue we were playing, you know, I was kind of playing as like a number 10 and not really suited to my strengths, but I just didn't play that great for DC. And when you get an opportunity to go and get Dwayne DeRosario, I think he did the right thing.
Yeah, I mean, that was his MVP year, if I remember correctly.
It was.
I mean, he was unstoppable that year.
Guy, everything he shot went in the goal.
Magic.
It was unbelievable.
So how'd you get that call? What's that like?
I got that call from Ben. It was actually a text, and he was like, hey, are you around today? It was our day off.
Never want to get that text.
He was like, you want to grab a coffee? And I'm thinking, So I actually reach out to my boy, Chris Pontius. Chris, RIP, great career, though. Know he's going to be very successful, whatever he decides to do post-career. But I call Chris, and I'm like, hey, what do you think this is? He's like, oh, I don't know. It's probably nothing. He probably just wants to meet with you about tactics. And I'm just like, okay.
It's like a weird way to meet about tactics.
As a player, you have your senses, right?
Yeah, your senses going.
You get your spidey senses going on. Your soccer sense is like, I don't know what's going on here. So we meet Ben. He sits me down. We get a coffee, which we shouldn't have even gotten a coffee. Like I told you, I think this was when I still drank hot chocolate. So I think he was kind of...
You were making the order when people got...
I was being judged 100%.
Yeah, for sure.
But Ben was like, look, I really like you as a player. When I sat you down and made you captain, and I told you we were building this thing around you and Pontius and Nahar and Hamid and a bunch of young guys, I meant it, but... This team right now, where we're at, we need a guy like Dwayne DeRosario, and New York Red Bulls, they really want you. And they were very adamant about you were one of the only guys that they would take. And I think Andy back then was like incredible. Nahar, if you ever remember watching him, but I don't think he was movable. And they were just like, we're going to pull the trigger. And so you've been traded to New York. And it all came back to me. I had flashbacks because I had Shellis Hinman constantly calling me into his office around like 2009, 2010 in Dallas saying, the New York Red Bulls keep calling about you. They keep wanting to trade for you. And I got to tell them to leave me alone because we don't want to trade you there. And then so it all came full circle when Ben said that I had been traded to the Red Bulls. I thought, man, these guys, they must have really wanted me. They pursued me at two different clubs now. And I think it was it went down a little bit easier going to New York rather than going from FC Dallas to DC, going from DC to New York, because I hadn't been at DC that long. I wasn't really that settled. Mm-hmm. I didn't really experience, I think, all the city had to offer in DC. And mentally, it hurts. You know, whenever you get traded, I mean, any player will tell you, whenever you get traded, it's not a great feeling because it's always like, why? You know, you don't value me. But then you have to look on the bright side of it, and it's like the other club values you that much to go out and get you. You have to look at that side of it. So I think the Red Bull thing worked out pretty well.
How much does doubt play a role in a professional player's career?
A lot. A lot. You have to battle with a lot of internal demons, and you have to battle with these days. I mean, it was different back then, you know, before social media, you really just only had to deal with kind of what was in your head about, well, why am I not playing? Why is this guy playing over me? And you battle that all the time. You have a bad game. Does it spell the end of your time on the field? Are you in the coach's doghouse? You have to deal with stuff like that all the time. But now in the social media era, man, it is so much more difficult. And especially for young players. I mean, now, you know, with the experience I have, the age I'm at now, it's never get too high, never get too low. You know you're going to have some bad games, but don't go search your name on social media. It's only going to be bad news. You're never as good as everyone praises you and thinks you are, and you're never as bad as people think you are. So for me, there's always a little bit of doubt, but then it comes back to, listen, man, like, You're a professional athlete for a reason. Like, you've been trusted by numerous coaches to go on the field over whatever 100 games it's been and to do a job. And so don't let doubt creep into your head. Just get rid of it. Go back to what you're good at. Go back to what you know.
MLS.com, MLSsoccer.com, whatever it is we're calling this shop these days. Somehow, some way, we've made it into the news this year, especially with head coaches out in the Western Conference.
You guys are pretty famous.
Yeah, everybody knows about Adrian Heath. Everybody now knows about the Brian Spencer, Bobby Warshaw call out. How do guys consume media? Are articles or videos or power rankings, are those things discussed openly? Do guys go home and scroll through? Do you know people that have burner accounts? I mean, obviously, you're just right out there with yours. I mean, maybe one's hidden away, but how do MLS players consume? I know it's hard to be monolithic about this, but
right,
I can't imagine not being a professional and at least wondering what is this conversation.
Let's put it this way. You can be the most reserved, steely-eyed player out there, but in some form or another, you're still looking at what media is putting out there. So you don't have to have a Twitter. You don't have to have an Instagram. But you can still go on those websites and you can still see what's going on.
Yeah, you don't have to. That's true. You don't have to have a username.
You don't have to have those. You can just go on Twitter and you can just search whatever you want to search and you can see whatever you want to see. So it's so easy for players to consume media now. I remember back in the FC Dallas days. I mean, this is going to make me sound really old. And I mean, that's okay. I'm a little bit older. But guys, right now it's always phones, right? Cell phones, Twitter, Instagram. Back then it was newspapers. And you literally had the sports page. You had probably like 3 or 4 newspapers that were in the locker room. You'd go in the team lounge, you'd make your, you know, bagel or whatever it was, and you would wait for your teammate to be done reading the sports page, and then you'd go read the sports page, and you'd open the newspaper, look up at SportsCenter, you know, you'd read the newspaper, right? And so now it's just different because it's your cell phone, right? You see all the articles that are put out, and you go on Twitter, and you put in the hashtag, whatever your team's hashtag is, right? And you go and see what everyone's talking about with whatever happened in the previous games. And it's really difficult. It really is, because you find yourself down that rabbit hole. Maybe you're bored one day, maybe you have a day off, and now it's easier because I got a lot more going on, right? You got the house, you got married, little yeah. six month old at home who keeps you busy, and it's a lot easier to stay away from that stuff. But I think we've seen, I mean, look at like the comments from Bob Bradley and the comments from Schmetzer about Bobby and the comments from Adrian Heath about MLSsoccer.com, which are all kind of funny if you
yeah.
think about it.
Yeah, yeah.
People see it, and people can act like they don't, but they do. Now, how you handle that is one thing, right? So I can see something. If I see something on MLSsoccer.com, maybe Matt Doyle says that, you know, I was the worst defensive midfielder in the league this year. Well, I can choose to do one of two things. I can take what he says seriously, and I can say, well, screw this guy. He doesn't know what he's talking about. Or I can say, okay, maybe that's his opinion. I'm going to go prove him wrong, right? You got to fall into one boat or the other. And so as an older player, it's easier to stay even through it all. But as a younger player, man, I tell you, there's after national team games, I mean, the armchair analysts and the people that get the pitchforks out for players after they have one bad game on Twitter. I mean, it's absolutely mind-blowing. Sometimes I just go on there just to see the sky falling. I mean, I just see it. And then, you know, guy will have a great game and he'll be the next big thing. And you're just like, why do we always do that in this country, right? And it's probably a little bit of an epidemic everywhere you go. Probably England, Germany, they all have the same problems. But it's just like, you'd love to see the people that just stay a little bit even. They want to see like a little bit of the longer term, and they see the future of these young kids coming up, and they say, all right, they don't crown this kid if he has a great game, and they don't absolutely destroy him if he struggles. That's kind of the key to how I take in media, and it's very difficult. I'll put it that way.
Let's talk about a guy who's used to being under the microscope, and Thierry Henry's a legend. You go to the Red Bulls. You're playing with some legends. That was, when you arrived, still the Rafa and Thierry Henry era, yeah?
Yeah, it was.
And that, when we're talking about locker rooms, I have to imagine, was pretty interesting. What's it like being in a locker room with those two? Are they like, you know, is it the sun and the moon sort of opposite sides? Are they pulling things? Like, what's their gravity? What's their personality? How do they interact?
It was never dull, I'll put it that way. Those guys were always super interesting, engaging people to be around. And I'll talk about Rafa first. Rafa gets a bad rap, and probably rightfully so, because most people just see his exploits on the field, and they maybe just thought, he didn't care, he didn't want to be here, and he played like garbage, and he said things to the media, and it was just kind of a nightmare.
Chucked balls at LD.
Right.
Played the heel, had some bad tackles.
I believe infantile was the word he used to describe Tim Ream and his mistakes, but Rafa was a guy at the core of it who he just wanted to play beautiful soccer, and he just wanted to ping long balls and ping diagonals. And I don't think he was here just to get a paycheck, but I definitely don't think he was as engaged as he could have been, right? And I think that the appeal of New York and the appeal of playing with Thierry, it was too much for him to turn down, but I just don't think the adventure really worked out the way he wanted it to, or the way that the Red Bulls wanted it to, and MLS in general. So Rafa was a great guy, though. I remember after his last year in MLS, we had our end of the year meetings, and I was going to take the PATH train home because we had our meetings at Red Bull Arena, and Rafa, we both lived in the city at the time, and Rafa was like, hey, man, you just finished your meeting? Like, I'll give you a ride. Let's go. And he was great. In the locker room, he was fantastic. He was quiet. He cracked a few jokes here and there, and because he was quiet, you always were like, oh my God, Rafa.
Where'd that come from?
He's got a softer side, yeah. You know? And you're just like, oh, he's a good guy, really gentle. If you ever went to him for advice, he would never go out and he would never seek to be a vocal leader. But if you ever asked him, he'd tell you, and he would give you his opinion, and you took it. And so he gave me a ride home. He gave me a ride home in his, like, Porsche.
I was going to say, what's he whipping?
It was a Porsche Panamera, I think, at that point. And I think I'm like this big baller. I got my Audi hatchback A5, but I didn't drive. I was taking the train, I was in his Porsche, and he was so classy. He was still to this day the best dressed teammate I've ever had. Him and Nemanja Nikolic, they always came to training looking like $1 million, always. And Rafa, I was like, Rafa, what's going on with you? Are you going to come back next year? And he just started laughing and was like, Dax, I don't think so.
Yeah.
And it was very subtle, and it was just like, but you never know in football. And that's the truth, man. If I've heard one slogan that I think you can talk about with soccer, you just never know about anything. You never know what's going to happen. You never know certain games. Last night, we all picked LAFC. Seattle won. You just never know what's going to happen. And Rafa ended up leaving. I think he went back to Mexico and ended his career there. I think he went to like a 7th World Cup or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Atlas, I think he did that as well. Thierry, though, has a reputation of both not suffering a fool, but also being incredibly warm when the time called for it. I think what I've heard is you're one of the guys that had a good relationship with him.
I did. And I think Thierry, he's very intimidating. I mean, the first thing you think about when you see this guy is like, oh my God, fast, amazing player. But then you actually meet him in person and you're like, why are you so tall?
Yeah, he's massive.
Why are you
just
so
as
big?
As a human, he's
just a big guy. He's like 6'3", and you're like, when did you grow? Like, I saw you on TV playing for Arsenal, and I thought you were like 5'10", super fast and just tricky guy. And then you see him when he was playing for the Red Bulls, he was like more stocky. He was like more thick and more filled out, a little bit more muscular. And then you're like, you're so big. Thierry was just one of a kind. There's really just no other way to describe it. There were some days where you were like, is this guy bipolar? And then there were other days where you were like, he's the nicest human being on the planet, you know? And he's super generous, and he's laughing, and he's joking, and he's having a good time. And my time with him was some of the most valuable time I've had in my career. And I learned a lot from him, I think.
What'd you learn?
I just learned to see the game in a different way. I learned that there's certain aspects of being on the field that it only comes with guys who see the game in a certain way. And Bastian Schweinsteiger is the same way. These guys solve problems on the field in their head by just having a high soccer IQ. And it's nothing to do with physicality. It's nothing to do with athleticism. It has everything to do with, for example, if a defender's on your back, right? And Thierry would always, if a defender's on your back and I get a ball played into my feet, if he's backing off me, I know I can take a touch, I can turn, I can face him up, I can do whatever I want. If he's on me aggressively, well, I know I'm going to turn this guy and I'm going to run past him. And it's just having a little bit of a sense of what the game is calling for. And these types of guys that have played at the highest level, they have that. And that's, along with a killer mentality, like that is what separates them from everybody else. So it's situational awareness in the game. What does the game call for? And I think for me, I'm always the type of player, I want to play beautiful soccer all the time. And these guys are too, but they know what situations and games call for. And you can only really learn that if you have guys who say, listen, at this moment in the game, it's not time to do this. At this moment in the game, it's time to do this differently. It's time to do that differently. And so it's all about decision-making for them. And it's not that like MLS players are separated by that much. I mean, you have a guy who has a season like Carlos Vela, you're like, okay, clearly his talent takes him to another level. But the decision-making that players have on the field, that's what separates the good players and the great players. It's what decisions can you make in the moment at the highest level that are going to separate you from either missing a big chance, making the right pass, scoring a great goal, making the decision. I think let's take an example from the LAFC Seattle game. The second goal that Ladero scores. Matt Doyle covered it, and we were talking about it here. It's like Edward Atuesta is a best 11 defensive midfielder. He's a guy who plays fantastic soccer. He's a great passer of the ball. He scores bangers, scores free kicks, right? Scores great goals. But in that moment, your job as a defensive midfielder is to make a foul at midfield and just snuff the chance out before it comes. And he doesn't because maybe he's thinking, all right, I don't want to foul this guy. We'll win the ball back, and then I'll be able to make 10 passes, and we'll be able to go down and score a goal. But that's situational awareness, and those are the guys like Thierry and Bastian at the highest level. They make those decisions like nothing, and 9 times out of 10, it's the right decision. And so you take these little things that you learn from them here and there, and in my career, I think, you know, I still think I'm playing at a high level, but I think if you look at those Red Bull years, I mean, that's when I really came into my own as a player, and I was really more sure of myself and who I was.
What was the transition between Pecky Shields, Henri, Rafa, Big Stars, Red Bulls to Jesse Marsh's Red Bulls? How did you know things were going to change significantly? What were the signs?
It was the first meeting I had with Jesse was when I knew things were going to change. He pulled me. We had a meeting at a coffee shop in Hoboken, and he just said, "Look, things are changing around here. I think we're going to try to scale back from the high profile, big name, multi-million dollar designated players. And we're going to have a little bit more synergy with what they're doing over at Leipzig and what they're doing at Salzburg and what they're doing at their other locations. But we want to play a certain way that we think can be very successful in MLS. And, you know, he was describing it to me, and this was before, you know, this was right around the time, like, high pressing was
Sporting KC was doing it a little
Sporting
bit.
Sporting KC was doing it a little bit. You had Klopp at Dortmund who was doing it some, and it was kind of, no one really knew like if it would.
It wasn't the ubiquitous thing that it is now.
It wasn't. And it, the thing, the way that it's just changed, and even Sporting Kansas City, I don't think they,
not
I don't think.
Not at the intensity.
It wasn't at the intensity, and it didn't take the league by storm the way that the Red Bulls did, you know? And it was like Sporting Kansas City, they press, but they don't want that to be their identity.
It was part of who they were.
Jesse was like, all right, well, we're going to press, and like that's going to be our identity. Like, that's how we're going to score goals. That's how we're going to create chances. Like, teams are going to be so miserable playing against us that by the time they walk off that field, they're going to say, that was the hardest game we've ever played in. That was his ethos and his mentality. And I said, you know what? I'm all in. I'm on board. I'm a young guy. I'm a fit guy. Let's go. Let's do it. You know, who knows? I don't want to lose the, let's say, call it quality that you want to have while you play. But if that was the way that they wanted to go, that was the way they wanted to go. And so you have the Thierry years, the Petke years, where we were heavily reliant on Thierry to just make something out of nothing. We had a pretty good team. We won the Shield, our first Shield in 2013 and first trophy in Red Bull's history by playing some pretty good soccer. But again, you still had Thierry coming out with moments that were just make your jaw drop, right? And so we were heavily reliant on him. Play through the midfield, Thierry would drop to the left, he would drop to the right, he would come place D-mid, you know, he would come get the ball off the center backs, and he would make some magic happen, and that's what we relied on. But 2015 changed everything. That was a total collective team effort. You have Sasha coming back from Europe and having just a tremendous season. You go trade for Felipe to put in the midfield with me. You get Mike Grella off the scrap heap, and this guy's just dicing people up and doing N1 mixtapes. You have Lloyd Sam who and Brad, who were both English player, you know, English guys playing in the championship, playing in League One. Nobody really knew what to expect from them. And then you just kind of threw to cobbled together a back line and called it a, you know, a great team. And we, those teams, I mean, I think still to this day, I mean, that's some of the best coaching I've ever had was when Jesse was there and he was putting the team together. And look, the Red Bulls now, when I look at them, they are all out full press, and that's their identity. It always has been their identity, but that is literally like what they're about. Those early years in 2015 and 16, we still tried to play some soccer. We still had some soccer about us to where we really wanted to try to play out of the back, and we wanted to possess the ball, and we wanted to play little triangles and play pretty soccer. And like, I wanted to find the ball at my feet off the center backs. I wanted to play the ball in between the lines to Sasha, and he wanted to find Brad, and that's how we would score goals, right? And Jesse would get pissed sometimes because we'd watch video and he'd be like, guys, this is all really pretty soccer, but we're not running enough. We're not going forward enough. We're not running to goal enough. We're being too methodical in the way that we play, and this is not how we want to play. And it's just like, but we're playing good soccer. Like, come on, you know? Yeah. And that full transition, I think, happened probably 2018. You know, they had, before LAFC this year, they had the greatest season in MLS history where they just were unbelievable.
Suffocating.
Tyler Adams was at his devastating best. And that team, you know, that team, you could argue, maybe they didn't play as great of soccer as we did back in those 2015-16 years, but they knew who they were, and they were so sure of themselves that they were almost unstoppable.
You obviously had a high-profile trade here to the Fire. What's your relationship like with Jesse now?
My relationship with Jesse's fine. We haven't spoken in a few years, and if we did, it would be very respectful, very mature. me and Jesse had, after the trade went down, we probably had 5 conversations after everything went down, and it was a lot, you know. Even when I got to Chicago, we were still discussing it, and I was still telling him, you know, this is where I think you could have done better, and this is where I think we kind of had our wires crossed. And I've said this, you know, I've talked about it a lot. I still think Jesse's one of the best coaches I've ever had. I think he's a great coach. He's proving that over in Europe now in the Champions League. But the way that the trade was handled could have been handled differently, in my opinion. And you know, this is an issue that I think MLS is going to run into a little bit more of when, you know, you have guys that get a little bit older and guys make a little bit more money and they become expendable. It's like, how much should the human element come into it? You know, because at the end of the day, players are assets, but they also have feelings, man. Yeah. Like I had felt like, I think my initial feelings were like, you know, how are you just going to trade me behind my back when I feel like I've given so much to this club and you've been here 2 years?
I was the captain. I bought in. I was the captain. We're on the brink.
Right. And it's just, there's all these feelings and emotions, and you look at it from his side and he's like, well, yeah, but you know, we have to do what's right for the club and this and that. And I'm just like, that's totally fair. Right. That's totally fair. But doing right by the club and doing right by the player, depending on who the player is, I think those can exist together and those can coexist. And that was my biggest problem. But I wasn't dumb. I got injured, ironically enough, against the Chicago Fire. I fractured my tibial plateau. Just a guy named Tiam from Chicago just destroyed my knee. And I was out for like 8 weeks, seven weeks. And Sean Davis came in and played fantastic. And he was just tremendous, right? And then you have Tyler winning USL championships waiting in the wings. And so I'm thinking in my head, look, we have tremendous talent coming through. I'm not dumb, you know, and I signed a new deal. And at the end of the day, you know, you think you have conversations with people and you think you understand each other. And you know, then it comes out that, you know, before preseason, you know, and even everyone makes a big deal about, oh, my God, 2 days, a day after his wedding. I mean, that sucked, but it was closer to the season starting, you know, and preseason was right around the corner. I was with the national team and you find out and there were just, I think, ways that it could have been done differently. But honestly, my relationship, if me and Jesse were to ever talk, it would be a respectful soccer relationship. That's exactly what it would be.
What do you want to do after this is over? I mean, you guys still got some time left in you. Yeah. I don't know how many. Sasha says he wants to go to 40.
I think Sasha can go to 40. I mean, the guy's literally been at the same speed for 15 years.
Yeah, just
and
like
I say that to Sasha lovingly.
He's got a very replicable gait.
Sasha goes at the same speed for the last 15 years, but the guy still covers more ground than any player. Seriously. I mean, the guy is like a machine. He's just running at the same speed all over the field. He was so hard to track, and I believe Sasha can play till 40. If one guy can do it,
he you want to play that long? How long do you want to play?
40? God, 8 more years? Woo! I feel great, to be honest. My body feels amazing. I just had a season where I played in, I think, 32 games, one Open Cup game. And the games that I missed, it was for, you know, third game in a week. The coaches wanted to rotate a little bit. They wanted to rest. I didn't want rest, but I reluctantly accepted. So I feel great. You know, if I can play 4 or 5 more years, awesome. I don't want to play till I'm 40. But I feel good. I just, it's so exciting to be a part of the league right now and to see the growth and see where it's going. And it's like all these new expansion teams coming in. It's like, man, I want to play against Miami in Miami. I want to play against, you know, whoever, Sacramento and Sacramento, the newest team that just came in. I want to play against Nashville. I want to play against Austin. All these teams that mm-hmm. are coming in. It's like, I want to say that I played in MLS when there were like 12 teams, and now I'm in MLS when there's 30 teams. I mean, how cool would that be, right? And so I feel great. I want to play 4 or 5 more years and then call it a day. Do I want to coach? Maybe. Do I want to do what you do? Maybe. I enjoy the media side of it. I really do. I imagine some people get sick of hearing my voice because I talk so much, but that's something I enjoy. I enjoy analyzing games. I mean, I analyze my own games, and I watch myself play, and I always figure, well, why did I make that decision? I can do better here. I can do better there. And even covering these games and watching LAFC in Seattle, you know, the different ways that you think about the game. And I'm going to stay involved in soccer. There's no question about it. What that is exactly, I'm not sure.
Got a couple years to figure that out. One last one for you before we get out of here. You mentioned it, like 12 to 30. I mean, this league, breakneck pace, completely different year to year. We have 5 expansion teams waiting in the wings, 2 more to come next year. From a player's perspective, what is the biggest difference from that day you walked in as a rookie until now? What's the thing that you look back and you think, man, I never imagined that this would be here, whether it's facilities or coaching or level of players and competition you're up against?
Training facilities and academies, and the investment that is going into the academies. I remember back when I turned pro, Pizza Hut Park had just opened. And I don't know, what do they call it now? Toyota Stadium? Is that what it's called? Okay. Yeah. Pizza Hut Park was like, and this was like in Frisco, right? And it was just, you had all this space and there was nothing there but a stadium and like 20 fields. And it was like, this is where we're going to have Dallas Cup, and this is where we're going to host all these big tournaments, and this is where we're going to train and all this stuff. And it was like, at the time, unheard of, because teams were training at high school football stadiums. Teams were training at parks, public parks. Teams were doing all kinds of crazy stuff. Teams were having to carpool, get in a locker room, go to one locker room, jump in a car, drive 10 minutes to a training field. Like, it was literally just mayhem. And we had this situation at Pizza Hut Park. It was like, you go to the same place every day, you go to the same locker room every day, you get changed, you walk like 100 yards out to the practice field 1, and that's where you trained. I mean, that was amazing. No other team had that set up, right? No other team had that situation. Now, you look at the situation, and not necessarily the fire, but you look around the league, New York Red Bulls training facility, NYCFC, Toronto FC.
Atlanta United,
LAFC, Montreal Impact. Still
Sporting
FC
Kansas
Dallas.
City
Sporting
is unbelievable.
You look at...
Salt Lake just built a massive complex.
Salt Lake's complex, I heard,
Star
is just
Starfire, Timbers
incredible.
Have it. I mean, everybody has it.
You look at it from top to bottom, and it fills me with so much pride to see that, okay, yeah, MLS is growing off the field, fan support, coverage of the media, you guys, MLSsoccer.com, even ESPN, Fox, even the Spanish language channels, right? The coverage is incredible. But just to see like how much money is being invested into the game, and it's not just at the highest level of MLS, right? It's at the grassroots, it's at academy level, right? Where academy kids are being churned out at a really fast pace now, where it seems like new homegrowns are signed every year, and these homegrowns are just getting better. The quality of the homegrown is getting better. The quality of the young players is getting better. And it's not perfect. It's not where it needs to be. We still need to continue to grow. And one thing that I believe is that coaching can get better at all levels. No question about it. I think the coaching in this league, and it's cool to see how well former players, American players, have done as coaches. I think I love that. I take a lot of pride in that. But it's also to see MLS teams not being afraid to go higher from outside the league and stay outside that bubble. What Alameda did in San Jose was tremendous.
Tata, obviously.
Tata. Even Frank DeBoer. That guy was getting crushed early in the season, and he's on the verge of possibly winning 3 trophies this year. I mean, you have to talk about that. right? And so all these different things, Tab Ramos just got hired. He's American, but he was coaching at the youth level. I think he's a really hot name, right? I mean, all kinds of things are happening in this league that are so exciting to be a part of. And for me, the facilities and the infrastructure that's being built for the future generations, that's something that I can look back on and say, wow, I can't believe I lived through that.
All right, Dex. Thanks for walking down memory lane with us here. That's it for this interview, MLS Storytime. We'll be right back.